Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
From Brandeis University, welcome to Recall This Book, where we assemble scholars and writers from different disciplines to make sense of contemporary issues, problems, and events. And I think today maybe our title says it all, Land Grab Universities. The relationship of American higher ed, not just in Western states, to the expropriation of Native American lands that characterized settler colonialism's creep across the continent. So I'm John Plotz, a science fiction scholar and your regular RTB host. And joining me today is a new host from here at Brandeis, Jerome Thoreau, my colleague in the English department, author of a wonderful book on 19th century literature, art, and religion called Apocalyptic Geographies, Religion, Media, and the American Landscape. So Jerome, welcome. Hi.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Yeah, it's awesome to have you. New faces. And we're happy to welcome, for reasons that will become obvious, Dr. Robert Lee, whose PhD is from Berkeley. He was a fellow at Harvard and is now an assistant professor of history at Cambridge. A very impressive instance of eastward migration, Bobby. So hello and welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So I'll just say that his work generally focuses on indigenous dispossession and U.S. state formation in the 19th century American West. And specifically, he has a cluster of articles in a database, all linked to in our show notes, in which that title, Land Grab University, is first aired. So Bobby, can we just start by asking you about that project? And I should say you worked on it with the celebrated journalist Tristan Athone, a member of the Kiowa tribe, incoming editor-at-large at Grist, who previously served as editor-in-chief at the Texas Observer and Indigenous Affairs editor at High Country News. I just wanted to sort of slip that biography in, since obviously, you know, this is so much about your work, but I assume a lot of it is work that you did with Tristan as well.
Yeah, it's an important point. Land Grab Universities is a collaborative project. It's also a multimedia project, and I hope we can talk about both of those aspects. But just to give you a little bit of the subject matter background of what it's about, it is about the history of land expropriation for the benefit of land-grant universities in the United States. I'm sure all your listeners have heard of land-grant universities. In the most material sense, they're called land-grant universities because they receive lots of land from the federal government under the Morrill Act of 1862, a land law that's passed in 1862. And the investigation was an effort to sort of unspool the big confusing knot of where this land came from and what were the indigenous nations that the United States acquired this land from, and how did it redistribute and capitalize this land for the benefit of endowment building for land-grant universities, mostly in the 19th century, but into the 20th century, and in order to build these endowments, in order to sort of seed the land-grant university program. So the investigation was, a digital humanities investigation where we were trying to track down, map and sort of unspool the knot completely to connect all of the indigenous nations that the land and land grant universities came from to the universities that they benefited.
Great. And Bobby, just the key point for me, at least, that was a revelation. If you could sort of unpack that, the land grant university, I always associated it with, the University of Nebraska was given some land to build this campus. But the land grants you're talking about do not operate that way at all. They operate at a distance, right? The university and its land can be far separated from one another.
Well, that's right. But with the land grant university system, there are exceptions. So there are a few universities that did acquire land for their campuses through these land grants. But for the most part, no, it's not about the land that's underneath the campuses. It's about land that's at a distance that can be sold or managed in order to raise funds for endowments. So this is land that in some cases is hundreds of miles away, in some cases thousands of miles away from the universities who benefited. There were really two main ways in which universities were able to take advantage of this act, the way that it was administered differed geographically. So universities, states that were had universities in the East had to select land in the West, surveyed land in the public domain that had been expropriated through various treaties, ratified treaties, unratified treaties, land seizures, and surveyed into those parcels that you see when you look out the window when you're flying in a plane across the United States, and then to select parcels from anywhere on the surveyed public domain of the United States, because public land, federal land, isn't in eastern states. The public domain is in the West for the most part. And western states had to select land to build up their endowments that was within the boundaries of their individual states. So all of the University of California's land under the Morrill Act comes out of California, but there are also maybe 30 other universities that benefit from land selections in California in the mid-19th century. This is going on during the time that you have the California genocide that's been written about a lot in the last few years going on. So the land redistribution differed by states, but it was generally land that was at a distance, used for the purpose of generating capital, not spaces on which to hold classes.
When you mention these selections, is that kind of like draft day in the NFL or something? Like, were they all invited into the room to pick from a map? Is there a moment of selection, or how does that work?
No, there's not a moment. A draft really isn't the right image. It's all decentralized. So for the most part, I mean, how this works with the land that universities in the East. So you guys are in Massachusetts. The beneficiaries of Massachusetts grant was MIT, and UCAS. They had to split it. Most of these states in the East that had these selections in the West, in order to actuate the selection, they got basically coupons. This is called scrip. This is land scrip that they could use. Basically, it's a form. It says this is a piece of scrip for 160 acres under the Morrill Act of 1862 for the benefit of the state of Massachusetts. And then they have to fill in where the land is. But they don't have to do it themselves. They can sell that. They can sell the right to select it. So what most of the universities in the East, what most of the states benefiting universities in the East did was they just sold the scrip in bulk for the most part to speculators because they didn't want to deal with the administrative costs of actually going through the whole selection process. There were major exceptions to this. Cornell, which is the largest beneficiary of the Morrill Act, was a major exception to this. Brown tried to at first engage in selections, but then it abandoned the effort. So most of these sort of sold the scrip or the coupons off to large speculators so they could, because part of the way that the act worked was that you could only live off the interest. So there was an incentive to raise capital as quickly as possible. And you could do that by selling off the scrip as quickly as possible to get the cash that you could then invest and start using for the benefit of the university. It was different in the Western states that had to select land within their states. they tended to set up, because they didn't get script, they had to actually go through the process of selecting, and they set up these land boards. The University of California basically ran a real estate office out of the university for decades. And they were acting like any other land speculators would in the 19th and the early 20th century, and looking for the best parcels that they could acquire to then resell. And then you have a whole nother phenomenon where universities wind up not selling this land. This happens a lot in sort of the mountain states in the West and the later territories that became states and were grandfathered into this program. I mean, it couldn't be like a draft, because this was a sort of evolving program, right, where as new states were created, they were grandfathered in and joined in and became beneficiaries of the Morrill Act.
So in other words, like New Mexico in 1912 or whatever gets.
Yeah, handed. they come much later, and they don't get their Morrill Act. They don't get their Morrill Act sort of a portion until much later. And a lot of these later states wind up holding on to the land. So we did a follow-up story that showed that there were around 500,000 acres of the Morrill Act land that were never sold. They're still held on to by the states. And in many cases, these parcels are, they're leased out, and they have been able to sort of keep up with inflation in a way that the capital raised from the original grants is not, because the way that the program was structured, you had to spend the income that was produced every year. So you didn't have this effect of sort of compound interest growing the pot from $100,000 to, you know, what it would be today if it had compound interest. It's still $100,000 for a lot of these early grants, you know, if that's what they originally raised. But it's different for the ones that were able to hold onto the land. They are able to set current leasing prices and to earn more money out of it. This is why South Dakota State University, which we mentioned in the article, the sort of main article in the project, which was out ahead of the curve and sort of reallocating the use of these funds, they were able to reallocate them towards the student needs of Indigenous students. But those were more than symbolic funds, because they had this land that's still generating probably a few $100,000 a year in income.
So could I, Bobby, ask us to go back a minute when you were talking about the sort of the West versus East dynamics of this. So in the article, you describe 11 million acres broken up into 80,000 parcels of land scattered mostly across 24 Western states. And so I'm looking at the map, and I see that there are more universities in the East, and that most of the land, which is in purple, is in the sort of the plain states in the West.
And I should say all of these links and the map itself will be up on our website. So you should definitely navigate through the show notes to take a look at it.
So, and I thought that the example you gave of the University of California and Cornell was really illuminating, because you know, you point out that like University of California, which only got land within the borders of the state of California, got something like $740,000 worth in Morrill funds, whereas Cornell got $5.7 million worth. And so that it kind of made me think of this older story of colonialism in the West as a resource colony, you know, a plundered province, as Bernard DeVoto famously called it. And so I'm just wondering, you know, how we should think about the relationship of those two forms of colonialism, the sort of extractive resource colonialism versus the settler colonialism that I think is the focus of your story.
I don't know if I would draw such a stark distinction between the Eastern states benefiting from the West and the Western states benefiting from the West. I mean, this is all a form of colonial extraction. It just, you know, it's different, the sort of distance that they're operating on. This was an issue in the 19th century. There were certain controversies around the passage of the Morrill Act at all. There were, you know, there were Westerners who were saying, why should Easterners benefit from land in the West, you know, not thinking at all in terms of the colonization of the continent from Indigenous people, thinking about, you know, who among the settlers in this space should benefit from its exploitation. Then there was the other half of the coin where, and this is an argument that Justin Morrill, who was the Morrill Act is named after Justin Morrill, who was a senator from Vermont, a congressman and a senator, when he was pushing, who sponsored the bill, when he was pushing for this, one of the arguments that he was making was that Eastern states had had earned the right to sort of plunder the Western provinces, as you put it, as payback for doing things like building the infrastructure, like canals and turnpikes that eased passage into the West for settlers, right? That made it possible and attractive for Easterners to move into the West, and they conceptualized this as sort of a payback. And of course, and then there were differences of where their congressional delegates would come down on this. You know, it wasn't unanimously passed. I don't remember the exact breakdown, but there were real arguments about who should reap the benefits of colonizing the continent. But for all of them, it was a process of colonization and resource extraction. It was about who was going to accrue the benefits and where. Was California going to be the sole benefit of the lands within California, or was it going to be distributed across the states? But there are a tremendous amount of what's known as Indian claims cases in the 20th century. I don't know if you've heard of it or maybe read about it somewhere. It's something called the Indian Claims Commission, which ran from the mid 1940s until the late 1970s, and was supposed to be a vehicle to process legal claims connected to broken treaties across the country. I mean, it didn't live up to its promise in a lot of ways, and it was geared more towards extinguishing claims rather than providing real economic redress. But there were hundreds of these cases, more than 800 of these claims that were processed in the mid 20th century. The most famous of these is the Black Hills case that eventually makes its way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court in 1980 decides that the Sioux land in the Black Hills was stolen in the 1870s, in the 1860s and 1870s, and they were going to give an award of approximately $100 million to compensate for that. And the Sioux said, no, we're not taking that. And it's still unresolved to this day. But there are lots of these cases in the mid 20th century. And this was the source that we actually used because one of the mandates for litigating broken treaties was to figure out what were the damages. And in order to figure out the damages, part of that was figuring out what was paid originally for the land. You know, were the treaties live up to what extent were they? So in the mid 20th century, the federal government engages in this massive forensic accounting investigation process in order to look into these cases. And one piece of that forensic accounting is figuring out what was paid for all these treaties in the 19th century. So this is the way we can figure out how much was paid originally for this land. It's using those sources.
So in the article, you make a distinction between parcels seized by unratified treaty versus those seized by treaty. And so I was curious about what the difference is and why that's important. Because, you know, in the article, you quote Jameson Sweet as saying, you can point to every treaty where there's some kind of fraud, where there's some kind of coercion going on. And so that would seem like, well, even when the land is ceded by treaty, you know, it's still stolen land. And so why is the distinction between being seized by unratified treaty versus ceded by treaty? Why is that important?
Well, it's important for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, in the context of the research for the article, we were trying to figure out what was the difference between what was paid to extinguish indigenous title and what was raised from what was raised for the endowments, the capital that was raised, to be able to see what that and quantify what that difference was. When it comes to the difference between ratified and unratified treaties in that context, ratified treaties typically would have some kind of a token payment. You know, this might be a few cents an acre. Sometimes it might be as high as 10 cents or 25 cents an acre. But mostly in the range of, you know, 1 to 3 cents an acre. Unratified treaties are land that is, literally an unratified treaty means it's unratified by Congress. They made an agreement, sort of in the field. This is, I mean, this is a story of California. California's all unratified treaties in the early 1850s. They make this, all of these treaties, 18 treaties across across California. Congress never ratifies them. So they technically never become the law of the land. The land is taken. The land's taken under these treaties, but no payments are ever made. There is no fulfillment of these treaties. So California is really the epicenter for that, although you also see it in other places, in other places, Oregon, in Nevada, there are lots of unratified treaties, but no payments at all would have been made for unratified treaties versus ratified treaties, where there would have been a relation set up and some sort of token payment.
So in other words, like New Mexico in 1912 or whatever gets handed, yeah.
So as you did that research, what surprised you as your data emerged? I mean, was there an aha moment?
Well, we didn't know what it was going to look like. And it's not so much, it's not so much an aha moment, but it's like, yeah, we should have known moment, right? When you look at that map that you were talking about before that, that's linked on the site that shows all of the 80,000 parcels, that's like the investigation, like in miniature on one page, you know, the picture of where all these parcels are. The map was made by Margaret Pierce, who was a cartographer for the project. At the beginning, we talked about sort of collaboration of this. That's Margaret Pierce's work. But we didn't know what that map was going to look like. But now that we see it, it's obvious why it looks the way it does. If you take a look at it, what you're going to see is a big sort of half crescent that goes from Missouri up until up through Wisconsin, into Minnesota and Wisconsin. And it's sort of like this this half crescent shape of parcels. This was where the sort of main property frontier was in the 1860s and 1870s. So this is why the script was located in this way. This was sort of the hot property market. What you also see is a cluster in California, in the Great Central Valley of California, where this is a really other dense set of parcels. This is other script that's being snapped up in the 1860s and the 1870s in California, which is the other hot land market. So this is just the sort of, it's sort of a pedestrian story of the beneficiaries of these universities, you know, doing what others were doing at the time, what the sort of larger land markets were doing. Because I mean, the Morrill Act acres, and I was describing it a couple of minutes ago, as this huge land area. It's still just a drop in the bucket of the amount of land that's being churned, indigenous land that's being converted into settler property in the 19th century. What we're talking about in all is like more than a billion acres over the course of the 19th century. And this is like 10 million acres, 11 million acres. That's like 1% of it.
Yeah. That's one thing that's, I mean, was surprising to me and made me think differently about efforts to return land. You know, and when I think of land back, I tend to think of places like the Black Hills or, you know, national parks or, you know, public, large, contiguous tracts of public land. But then when you start thinking about those 80,000, you know, parcels of land where some are like in Walmart parking lots and some are on playgrounds in California, you know, and it reveals just how complicated the process of achieving justice would be, and sort of makes me wonder, I guess, like is returning land feasible, or since these parcels have been kind of capitalized, right? Like they've been invested and turned
digested
into money, turned into endowments. Is the best mechanism for justice through the kinds of scholarships like you were talking about at South Dakota State? Or are there other models?
Yeah, I mean, there are sort of two tiers of feasibility or ease of feasibility of land return, which is land specific to the distribution under the Morrill Act. The land that's still retained by the states, so the small percentage, about 5% or so, that's still retained by the states, That could be returned by the states. I mean, it would be a matter, the real challenge would be political, because you would have to go to the state legislatures and convince them to divest themselves of this land. And most of this land is in Western states that are controlled by Republican state legislatures. Not that I would expect a different outcome from Democratic state legislatures, but I think the hill would even be a higher to climb in a lot of these deep red Western states to convince them to divest themselves of this land.
The other, though, California might be an interesting test case. Sorry, Bobby. Just in terms of thinking about a Western blue state, maybe California, there would be more friction between competing political interests.
But they are in the category of having sold all of their land.
So they're
in the second category of having distributed their land into the open market, the real estate markets of the United States. This is the place that that's been chopped up and turned into tract housing. It's been turned into baseball diamonds, you know, into various private public property of all sorts. So it is in the same boat as property on the public domain of the United States. It's really no different. It's just it reached the market through a different law. But there are thousands of these laws in the 19th century that produced the sort of mosaic of property that we have in the former public domain of the United States. But then when it comes to sort of different or more creative solutions to what to do, and California is a good example. I mean, California, University of California owns other land that they have acquired over the course of the late 19th and 20th and 21st century. And you could think of people are thinking about this, about trying to come up with new types of partnerships for sharing or controlling these spaces, or returning other land, or creating, you know, programs that could redirect the funds that are not only being produced, but to pay back what's been produced over time through the Morrill Act. And that could be channeled into a number of different things. When people talk about this project, the question of, you know, what now, what next, often comes up. You know, what do we do now? And these often revolve around what land grant universities can do in terms of expanding enrollment, changing curriculum, providing better services, and more recruitment of indigenous students, staff, and faculty. Various programs that are going on. I mean, South Dakota State is one of them. We've seen some action sort of moving in this direction. The University of Minnesota seems to be active in this way. Ohio State University has created a partnership with the First Nations Development Institute to think about what moving forward with the full knowledge of the Morrill Act can look like for them. It's still to be seen what's going to come out of that. But there are other sort of creative solutions that could be put in play.
Sorry, this is probably a totally different research project that one would have to undertake, but do you have any idea of what the numbers are of Native American or Indigenous students who've gotten degrees at these universities? Like, do they represent the vast majority of all Native Americans who've ever gotten college degrees, probably came through one of these universities? Or do you know what those numbers look like?
I don't know what they look like specifically, but one of the reactions to this piece was a study that appeared in the Native American and Indigenous Studies Journal by a pair of economists who were not asking that question precisely. They were asking the question, how well have land-grant universities served Indigenous students vis-a-vis non-land-grant universities? Not saying exactly how many. But in general, what they found is that land-grant universities were not statistically better, or had a statistically more significant record of providing educations to Indigenous students than non-land-grant universities. There are some that enroll larger numbers than others. University of New Mexico versus something like Cornell. We did include on, there were three parts of the project that you sort of mentioned at the beginning. There's the article, there's the database, and there's a website. And so on the website, landgrabu.org, there are pages for each university And one of the statistics that we did collect for each one of the universities is what is the proportion of Native Indigenous students today for those universities. I think the statistics on there, I think, are 2019 or 2020, whichever mm-hmm. ones were the most recent ones published when the story came out. But so we have a tiny sliver of that story that's waiting to be written there.
I was thinking about that Walter Benjamin idea that every document of civilization is also a document of barbarism. And I was thinking about the ways in which one of the things I love about this project is that it helps us see universities, well, as you said at the beginning, as kind of like the railroads, as instruments of, you know, expropriation and extinction of Native land claims. And yet also they are like the places that we go to if we want to study questions like this. Like, they're both of those things. And so the kind of prosaic question I had is, there's a way now that universities are trying to grapple with that through the land acknowledgement process. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts, given the land acknowledgement that you're proposing is not so much the acknowledgement of the acres that we're standing on, but it's more about those acres all the way over there that were extinguished, I guess, in order for this university to be founded or to, you know, to be funded. So yeah, whether you have thoughts about that question about like the land acknowledgement as a way of grappling with the double legacy of universities or other ways that we can think about that double legacy.
Yeah, the Benjamin quote is a great way of thinking about the sort of paradox or the contradiction that's embedded within the land grant universities. On the one hand, these sort of sites of progress, of development. I mean, this is a story that you see in the things like the murals that they have up at these land grant universities, where it's like a vision of American progress through technological development. And there's a lot of great things to say about what land grant universities have done and produced. I mean, as a graduate of a land grant university who's responsible for a lot of the vaccines that we get as children, you know, the things that we use, television tubes have been developed at land grant universities. There are a lot of wonderful things, the food that we eat, the dominant corn variety that is in most of the food that Americans eat is developed at a land grant university, whether or not that's a good or bad thing.
Yeah, that's that one is a mixed blessing.
I'll leave that to listeners to decide, but it has been a transformative thing that's been cast as progress. And for most of sort of the period of sort of public memory and historical writing about land grant universities, it's been about telling that side of the story. The story of progress and development that comes out of land grant universities. But the flip side of that is the flip side of every parcel of land that's been plucked out of the public domain in the United States. On the one hand, you have this this history of disposal of the gain of individuals of this property. On the flip side is the history of colonialism and resource extraction that's been traditionally sort of left out of the story. And land acknowledgements have been one solution, and I think a highly problematic and imperfect one to recognizing that duality. One of the things that we were trying to do with this project was to show, one of the many shortcomings of, I think, land acknowledgements. So land acknowledgements were you know, they first took off outside the United States. It sort of migrated. They're this global phenomenon where settler societies recognize their presence on expropriated indigenous land. And the problem becomes when that is a sort of a performance in itself rather than a starting point for some sort of material change or concrete action that moves towards redress. But what we were trying to show in the land grab universities project was that it's not just about the land that you're standing on. It's the whole ways in which land has been capitalized to transform settler societies. And this is just one small aspect of it. So we have seen some changes in land acknowledgments in response to the research So for example, the Washington State University of Pullman incorporated some of our data about Washington State and the funds that they raised out of this into their land acknowledgement to acknowledge that. And not a lot of the others are doing that. What we've seen in reaction to the piece, especially lately, the Utah State University recently came out with the land acknowledgement. Cornell University adjusted its land acknowledgement to acknowledge its land grant history. But they are tending to focus on using land acknowledgements to cling to the idea that land acknowledgements are just about the land that you're standing on, not about the society that is developed around it. It's not about the buildings that you're standing in, which are also provided through this process of expropriation.
Right. Since you mentioned the global context, Bobby, can I just ask really quickly, are there comparable projects undertaken in other settler societies, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, South Africa? Are there records of those similar, like land grant university processes? Or
yeah, there are, especially in the British Empire. That is the context that I'm most familiar with, mainly through the work of one of the contributors to the forum that they had on the land grab universities project in the NACE journal, looking at this from a British colonial perspective. You see these universities under different forms in Australia, in New Zealand, in Canada. I mean, the whole, land grant universities, as they emerged and under the sort of, they didn't appear fully formed with the Morrill Act of 1862. This was a model that developed over a long period of time. I mean, from my research, I think one of the earliest land grant universities is, or land grab universities, is Trinity College Dublin. Which in the late 1500s gets Irish land that's been expropriated to start Trinity College Dublin. So using this sort of overseas colonization form of extraction, and then that model gets exported to the American colonies.
Yeah.
You see it in Virginia. You see it in New England.
That's fascinating.
Once you get to the 19th century in the United States, you have other land grants that are pre-Morrill Act land grants to build state universities. University of Missouri gets one of these. There's a university in Mississippi. It's no longer in operation. That was Jefferson Davis's alma mater that received a grant of indigenous land. There was a story that came out after we published Land Grab Universities in Scalawag magazine. That documented the University of North Carolina's pre-Morrill Act fundraising from the sell-off of Cherokee land. So there is this long history of doing this, and there's a wide history too. I'm not as familiar with. I know there's some in the Spanish Empire universities, in Mexico City, in Peru. There's a Potosi College. In the early colonial period that is benefiting through Spanish colonial land policies. This runs much deeper and much wider, but there's still a wide field of research left to be done on both on how it operates within what becomes the United States and how it operates globally.
Thank you. I really hope people looking for dissertation topics just pricked up their ears at that, because I'm really glad you made the point about it being outside just the British Empire. I assumed it was British Empire, so it's helpful to know that it's worldwide. That's great. Yeah.
I wanted to circle back a minute. You were talking about some of the responses from land grant institutions themselves in terms of their land acknowledgements. And I was just going to ask what the response to the story has been from Native communities.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a mix. Most of the body of the response has come from Native communities within universities. So Indigenous student groups, Indigenous faculty that have really been the central sort of driving force in asking their universities to respond to this piece or to think about what the history of the Morrill Act means at their universities. And that is where the main focus of reactions have been. There have been, some We've spoken at the Indigenous GIS conference. And some people there are working on issues related to that. We've gotten requests from some tribal nations for access or instruction on how to use the data set. But really, the propensity of the response to this piece has been Native communities connected to and embedded within university communities. The other set of literature that I tend to connect this research to is the emerging work on the capitalization of the university, primarily through its connections to slavery and the slave trade. This is really sort of the thrust where of looking at the university in this way came from, of rethinking and sort of tossing out really the old literature on land grant universities and thinking about them as participants in histories of colonization and exploitation and resource extraction. So thinking about like Greg Wilder's Ebony and Ivy and the reports that came out at Brown about slavery in the university and thinking about universities also as connected to the history of the colonization of indigenous lands.
Yeah.
I mean, it's important to remember that the Morrill Act is passed in 1862 in the middle of the Civil War, which is in large part a fight over where slavery is going to be able to expand into, about how indigenous land in the West is going to be exploited in places like California and in Texas, and what that is going to look like. And it had been, slavery and land expropriation had been connected in the United States all the way up to this point. I mean, especially in places like the South, where the removals of the 1830s are part and parcel of the cotton boom that allows the growth of the Southern economy and makes it possible for a civil war to happen.
Jerome, unless you have a final question, this might be a good time to pivot to recallable books.
Sounds good to me.
Okay. So as listeners will know, this is the moment where we ask our participants if they're, if you enjoyed this conversation, is there a book you would like to point listeners to? So Bobby, do you mind if we start with you?
Yeah. I want to draw attention to a much older book in this historiography of land grant universities that we were talking about. This is a book called The Wisconsin Pine Lands of Cornell University. And if you can tell from the descriptive title, it's an old school monograph. This is published in 1943 by Paul Wallace Gates, who was the dean of public land studies in the mid 20th century, really from the 1930s to the 1970s. And in the 1930s and 1940s, he was at Cornell. While he was at Cornell University for most of his career, he had access to the archives there, and he wrote what was one of the earliest and most sophisticated accounts of the disposal of land under the Morrill Act, using Cornell as an example. It's really a remarkable book. It's been reissued by Cornell University Press. It was published more nearly 80 years ago. It was reissued in maybe a second, third edition. And he argues, and I think correctly, that Cornell's land grant under the Morrill Act facilitated one of the most successful land speculations in American history, the raising of this, $5 million that exploded in value and made the university possible, made it the third wealthiest university in the United States from being a non-existent university 20 years earlier.
Yeah.
And it's really this wonderful detailed study of the land grant university system. But the really interesting thing reading it now is to be able to take a step back and to imagine how this very thorough, very detailed scholar just didn't want to, wasn't engaged with conceptualizing this whole entire aspect of the history of public lands. You won't find anything about Native people in this book. If it was being written today, I think it would be called The Ojibwa Lands of Cornell University. But it isn't, and it's really emblematic of what is distinguished about the long history of public lands scholarship in the United States, and what is short-sighted about it. It has this long history of developing, not thinking about the consequences, causes, and results of colonialism in the United States. Sort of most fundamental aspect of the topic that they were devoted to. So you have this huge, brilliant literature that is completely disengaged from the conquest of a continent.
Yeah,
it's really fascinating to read these days. And it's an old book, but it's widely available.
That's great. Doesn't Eve Sedgwick open the epistemology of the closet by saying, along with our epistemology of knowledge, we need an epistemology of ignorance as well? Like, in other words, a genealogy of the things that are not said.
Yeah. Questions not asked.
Yeah, that's great.
That actually leads pretty well into my recallable book, which actually is not a book, maybe appropriately, since we're talking about an article or a series of articles. And I suppose before I say that, I just want to make a plug for the High Country News as just like a resource for understanding all the issues, you know, in the West, that, I mean, there's nothing like it. And for people who want to teach those issues and teach stories like Land Grab University's story, they've got a great program where your students get free digital access for a semester. So it's a good resource.
Do you get a commission on this?
No. but at any rate, the source that I wanted to talk about is Brenda Child's essay, The Boarding School as Metaphor, about, of course, a different area of Native education, talking about the boarding school. And she's interested in how the boarding school became this kind of master metaphor for colonial processes, and in a way that in some cases sort of flattened the diversity of experiences that individuals and communities experienced within those institutions. But she asks this question. She says, is the boarding school experience overly remembered? Is it remembered at the expense of other significant events, tragedies, and practices of settler colonialism that also dramatically shaped American Indian people's lives? And so I was just thinking about that I guess the Native experience in higher education might be one of those less remembered aspects of Indigenous life. You know, I'm thinking of, to put my literary scholar hat on for a minute, just thinking about the, you know, classic works of Native American literature that I sometimes teach, whether it's, the protagonist Abel in A Housemaid of Dawn, or Tayo in Ceremony, or Archilde in Darcy McNichol's The Surrounded. You know, these characters, I guess those novels make a lot out of the elementary school education and the boarding school education or at least the sort of the colonizers' education. I would say they're not all in boarding schools, I feel like we read much less often in the literary record about the experience of Native people in higher education. Even though each of the authors that I just mentioned did attend public universities. So I don't know, our conversation about the tribal colleges just makes me feel like that is, an aspect of Native education that we should pay more attention to.
That's great. I love how in your non-book recommendation, you nonetheless slipped in three book titles. And I haven't read Housemaid of Dawn, so I'm very excited to read that. And my recallable book is kind of owes a lot, actually, to hearing Jerome give a paper about this book, but it's Willa Cather's The Professor's House. And she's, I thought of her originally because she is, a child of University of Nebraska. Like, it's inconceivable to think of this, young woman from the prairies rising up to become like a New York, literary force and novelist without going to University of Nebraska. But of course, also an instrument of barbarism, she's part of that settler colonial movement of Nebraska in the 1870s and 80s. And then Professor's House is, you know, probably best remembered as a novel that's kind of elegiac about the kind of lost world, quote unquote, lost world of the cliff dwelling Native American, sort of the New Mexican settlements that one of the protagonists visits. But it's also an academic novel. Like, it takes place actually on a campus with an older professor who is hearing the story of these, quote, lost worlds of Native American culture. So it just kind of, I think it's a beautiful juxtaposition of like the being elegiac about something, striving to understand it, and also profiting from the way that very same thing that you're trying to understand has been expropriated and extinct, you know, the claim to it has been extinguished and reinvested in the land grant university. So yeah, Willa Cather.
Okay. A product of the land grant university, I should say, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's my whole point. Exactly. Yeah. Bobby, thank you so much for coming. It's a great conversation. I really enjoyed it.
No, thanks for having me. It's great talking to you guys.
Cool. And I should just say quickly that Recall This Book is sponsored by Brandeis and the Mendel Humanities Center. Sound editing is by Naomi Cohen. Website design and social media by Miranda Puri of the English Department. And Jerome and I are eager, of course, to hear your comments, your criticism, and your thoughts on today's discussion and on Recall This Book generally. So please subscribe if you're not already a subscriber by wherever you get your podcast, and write a review or rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever. So from all of us here at RTB, thanks for listening.